Welcome to Thing Making, an audio podcast for, about, and by people who make things. Today on Thing Making, I'm talking with Scott Wright, who is Artistic Director of Earth Physical Theatre. Welcome to Thing Making, Scott.
Good afternoon.
We're sitting in the office at Earth at Carriage Works, and Scott has very kindly showed us around the workshop with a whole bunch of puppets there. Scott, can you give us a rundown on what Earth is about?
That's a really good question. I reckon Earth is the reward of three really good friends who started making visual theatre 25 years ago, and that, you know, in that 25 years we've kind of honoured a lot of the things that inspired us and influenced us, and have gone on to make theatre that now travels all over the world and pretty much are still in a position of being able to do whatever we want, because the company isn't based on a funding model.
Right.
So we make work that we then sell.
Okay, and you get commissions for work as well?
Sure, yeah, we get commissions as well. But, that you know, to date our most successful work is Dinosaur Zoo, which is currently touring the UK and the USA at the same time. And we're just about to go into the Asian market.
And those dinosaurs are a combination of animatronics and...
No animatronics.
No animatronics at all in them. So tell us what are they made of?
They're made from, I guess, you know, aluminium frames that have a variety of different types of foams and fabrics covering them to make the musculature and the skin. And those designs or that process changes kind of regularly as we explore other alternatives. Like, from the first ones we made in 2000 to what we're making now, there's a huge difference between...
So tell us about that. So the first ones that you made, were they made of a different material that you're no longer using, or the structure was different?
At the time we were using a lot of Tyvek.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, Tyvek was that sort of one of those buzz materials where everybody was sort of loving it. And we definitely pushed it to its limits by treating it, heating it, stretching it, distorting it, trying to make sort of a textural sort of skin and painting it and all that sort of stuff. But if you look at, say, Minmi, which is at the Victorian Museum, Melbourne Museum, she still has the same skin, and she's, I don't know, I would say that she's well overdue for a new skin.
Okay,
because the Tyvek, you know, over the time just doesn't stand up to the work that she has to do, which is being a tactile creature, or a creature that can be touched by the public.
Right. And also the thing about Tyvek is it's not as flexible as some of the material that you're using now. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, at the moment I think we're using cotton stretch lycra, which is, we're getting photographic printed these days.
Yes, okay.
But when we make a skin, we literally stretch a skin and then hand paint it using liquid neoprene and stuff, so that when you release it, it kind of bubbles and gives texture.
Yeah, okay. Rather than putting texture onto the fabric, it's the paint that's giving it that texture.
Yeah, I think some of our other earlier ones, we would make scales out of PE and those other favourite materials like membrane, and which are now, I can't even remember the technical name, but, you know, it's like we go through phases of having favourite materials materials that get used more and more.
Yeah.
We started using laser cutting and 3D printing to make some of the parts and connectors for the aluminium. So rather than, you know, once upon a time it used to be the sort of white nylon chopping blocks that you would cut up and hand make.
Yes.
So now we're able to
have 3D print them.
3D print them or to have them laser cut for us.
Yeah. So that makes it quicker and easier, but you can also tailor make it on the computer and 3D print it for exactly the specs that you want. So it's cheaper.
It's cheaper. It also means that we've kind of got, we're starting to develop a bit of a, our own sort of Meccano set.
Yes.
So things that have been developed for the dinosaurs are now being used in application to other puppets or other creations.
I've noticed that Dead Puppet Society in Queensland are making model puppets that they're selling now as a kit, really. So something similar, although they're combining 3D printing technology with hands-on making, but they're making models that they can then sell
as merch
to people to put together. Yes.
Well, and remember the Scullies and the Butcher that the stuffed puppets made?
Yep.
Not puppets, but still a lovely piece of merch.
A lovely piece of merch. So maybe you'll end up selling dinosaurs around left, right and centre.
We've got our program for our last show, which we, as a tongue-in-cheek, made as a mindfulness colouring in book, which is pretty... Well, it's not quite a puppet, but...
Is it? But are there cutouts in there that you can put together?
No. It's just a document. Just a.
Mm. So what are some of the projects that you're working on now? Can you tell us?
So in relation... I've been thinking about what you're saying about puppetry and technology, and I think one of the things that we have prided ourselves on is the sort of the people power and and making things mechanical rather than animatronic.
Okay.
And sort of valuing the, you know, we call ourselves a visual and physical company. And so the visual is driven by the physical. That said, you know, we are now using 3D printing and laser cutting to make our parts. We've got a new show called Prehistoric Aquarium, and in that we use accelerometers in some of the puppets. So accelerometers are what's in your mobile phone that allows you to use a GPS. It gives you global tracking or compass tracking.
Yeah.
And the accelerometers are in our bioluminescent jellyfish. And what we do in the show is that we bring children into the action and allow them to puppeteer the jellyfish. And what the accelerometers do is it means that the sequence or the lighting sequence that each of the jellyfish have is determined on how the child holds the puppet, how they move it, and its positioning, so that each one has its own unique set of changes in coloration and changes in patterns that they produce. So you're not kind of handing over carbon copies of exactly the same thing. You've got, you know, 10 amazing little creatures that have their own sort of visual vocabulary.
But how do the children determine what that vocabulary is? They don't know. So how do they interact with the jellyfish then?
It's a simple follow the leader. You know, like they in the show they observe the puppets moving around.
Yes.
And there's quite an elaborate sequence that they go through. And then the children are allowed to help the jellyfish swim.
Okay.
And so then the puppets are placed in their hands, and then the children sort of simply do whatever they feel like doing.
Yeah.
And whether or not they work out that the puppet changes colour depending on how they move it, it's up to them, and it's up to that moment in the show. No one's telling them what to do.
Mm.
We're just making a moment that allows them to explore, but is also quite beautiful and endearing for the audience to watch.
So that's the human element. And do you always keep that in mind as an approach to making your work, where to look at the human element that is going to be brought into it, either through the puppeteers or through the audience or both?
Yeah, actually, so if I was to use another example of a work that is only just just in its infancy.
Yeah.
I work with a group of disabled artists, visual artists from Launceston, and an industrial robot arm that's used for making cars on assembly lines.
Okay.
So I've been offered this robot arm to work, to include it in this project that I'm working on with these artists. And so the potential for that robot arm to become a third hand in operating a puppet,
yeah,
or to become something that functions or assists within the performance. It's big, it's orange, it's a robot arm, but the most important thing is the person that's in the space. You know? So
yeah.
I think technology is a great thing, but it's important not to let the technology take centre stage.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. I think I can see, I've been hearing after interviewing Sam Routledge, for example, from Terrapin in Tasmania, he talked about technology, and he said, one of the things he said in one of the podcasts that I'm making was that he always likes to have the human hand involved in any work that they do, so that the technology will always serve the human rather than the other way around.
Mm.
And so they always like to either see the human hand if they're using video or animation. And I can see that. I think you are saying a kind of similar thing.
Mm.
The technology is really great for, say, producing parts cheaply, or for using in terms of the context of the show, but then the human elements are still the most important element. And do you think, because you've had a lot of experience performing and working with different audiences, that the audiences really respond to that more than they might if they see a show without, like a spectacular show where we don't see the puppeteers or we don't see how things are operated?
I think that we all see things very differently to one another, and I think that I did this test quite a long time ago where I stuck a fish hook through my elbow and hung my arm from the roof and ran it through a pulley. And I borrowed a muscle simulator and attached that to my other arm. And I sat in a gallery for 8 hours and invited the audience to, could only have one go. They could either push the button or they could pull the string. Their actions would move one of my arms, but I wanted to see which they would go for first. And 7 times out of 10, they pulled the rope rather than push the button. And I believe the reason why they did that is because they can see the cause and effect. You push a button and you can't be guaranteed that the action that is happening is actually caused by what you've done.
Yeah.
So there's this skepticism of technology.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the success of, say, Warhorse was all about that, being able to see the puppeteer, and that it was really the skill and the and the ability for the audience to shift their disbelief, which made it such a huge success. And I would find it very hard to find a live show by comparison that completely hides its puppeteers, or that tries to use technology. Like, King Kong's not a great example, but, you know, for all of the money that they spent on it, and for all of the technology that they claimed that they were using, some of the greatest moments that people appreciated were the people flying in the air that were pulling the ropes, or the moment that Kong sort of lurched down the stage and thrust his head into the light. You know, one light and one puppet.
Yeah.
Not millions of dollars worth of technology that's making this LED screen move. Mm. It's really the simple things, and I think that comes back to what I was saying earlier about puppetry being a primary language, a first language, one that we used before we had verbal language. When we were cavemen or when we were more primitive, the ways that we would explain to our others what had occurred during the day would be done using inanimate objects. So, you know, the hunt for an animal, you know, would a large rock would serve as a diprotodon or as a mammoth, and, you know, little sticks would, or nuts or other smaller stones would represent where we were and how we snuck up on it. And we would tell that story around a fire. And, yeah, I think that we see all this evident in the way that children play. You know, that first language, before they have words, they communicate through very sophisticated ways of how they perceive the world and what they touch and how they move it around. And, you know, I kind of say this all the time, but, you know, when you're a kid, a pencil can be your friend and it can move around. Yeah, and you can talk to it and you can do lots of things, and you can be underwater and then immediately on the moon, and you can do lots of things. And that is, I think, the essence of puppetry. It's the shifting of disbelief, the agency that you give to what is perceived as being a lifeless object. It's only as you become older as an adult and you worry more about whether or not people like you or whether or not you're making enough money to pay off the mortgage or, you know, whether or not that you really deserve that review, that you become limited in the way that you see the world.
I've been writing and talking about how I think if we look at the practice of puppetry, we can learn a lot about, as humans, working with the non-human world, and that can have ethical and environmental change, so that the way that puppeteers listen to material and work with objects, for example, the way that puppeteers are receptive to the life that exists in, as you said, a rock or a cave wall, for example, as a screen, and some of the natural elements can be taken as a kind of prototype for practice of working with in collaboration with the non-human world. And I think some of that wonder that you talk about with that children have in the non-human world, I think is found with adults in between things that you can see and things that you can't see. So things that can be seen in terms of a puppeteer operating a puppet and things that can't be seen because it, maybe it's remotely operated with using technology. So a robot arm that's operated, say, perhaps by a computer, but with the interaction with the human element in there, is the space where I think wonder exists. And I guess that's what I'm kind of exploring with some of my work, but which I will get to in terms of what you're doing with Earth, is looking at the shadow image, which is a very tangible, organic, primitive, if you like, image with projection. And, you know, now there's ever more sophisticated 3D projection. I know that Earth have worked with puppets, with humans, and with projection as well. So how do you work with all these tools in your palette? How do you make the decisions of what to use when and why?
I think it comes down to what do we want to achieve and how do we go about achieving it. And we just use what we need. So
So for the Nick Cave, the show that you did, Murder.
So for Murder,
it had a range of elements in it, and on top, I guess primarily was the work of Nick Cave and the Murder Ballads.
Actually, no. I think the thing with Murder was that we used music that was inspired by Nick Cave. We didn't use Murder Ballads. We used his body of work.
Right.
So Nick has a long history or long list of songs that are about murder that are prior to the Murder Ballads. And the stories of murder that we focused on were 12 case studies that had happened in Australia in the last 50 years.
Okay.
And my experience with Ivan Milat.
Yep.
And so it was it was a combination of a lot of things, and I think Nick Cave's music kind of became a device that sort of helped to sell it.
Yeah. Okay.
And there I was criticised for not using enough Nick Cave in the show, which is quite ironic because I am a bit of a Nick Cave sycophant, and there was probably more Nick Cave in that show than anybody will ever know. Like, there were songs there that Nick, you know, will openly say inspired a certain song. You know, it wasn't just doing his song with Kylie.
Yeah.
It was looking at a long history of his music. And so some of the people who criticised it obviously don't know Nick Cave as well as I do.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But going back to the approach.
Yeah. So we'd been playing with projection, and we'd used that in a show that we did previously called I, Bunyip. And so we were looking at how projection could serve as a way of delivering our backdrop or... in order to change our environment, because we were jumping around through a lot of kind of ideas and a lot of concepts. We were looking at, you know, the violence in computer games. We were looking at historical elements, but we were telling it through the eyes of a man who was questioning whether murder could be a good thing. And so we had tiny cameras on stage that sort of projected back his actions in that he was performing one of my recurring nightmares in a pizza with little tiny puppets, and so that was, you know, his thoughts were projected. I think what we did was we just used the projection as a texture, really. We could probably use it more effectively, but there are a lot of ideas that were going around in that work, so it's probably deserving of another restaging of it in order to be clearer about what we were doing with the technology. Like, we were, you know, music was very much a part of it as well, and we were sort of trying to... We're trying to make the audience complicit in the action of allowing someone to be killed on stage.
Yeah.
And so the way that we use projection was to shift in and out of a manufactured environment to a very sort of almost sort of real, super real environment. So at times people could feel like they were really experiencing something that was happening.
And obviously the puppets in that show were significant and used to their full effect in terms of the fact that puppets can die and be killed.
Absolutely.
They can kill and not be liable. So.
And that was kind of one of the driving forces in it, was that in puppetry you can kill a puppet and then you can kill it again and again and again. And the thing was that... some members of the audience were just horrified by it. Like, you know, there was one scene in particular where actually no one ever saw anything. There was a few gross bits that happened at the beginning of that scene, but effectively we did all of the killing and the brutalizing and stuff behind a bed. But the audience had gone... We'd managed to take that audience on such a journey that they were visualising it themselves.
That's right. So caught in between what they could see, what they couldn't see, using the imagination to fill in those gaps can be quite powerful. So I'm really hoping that we get to see it on tour around Australia sometime in the future. And what's happening for Earth and for you in the future? What are you experimenting with, or what are you interested or excited about?
So the stuff that I'm personally interested in is the work that I've been doing with children and with Chiara Guidi, the Italian director, and the whole kind of the shift in what a show is for a child. And, you know, we've never been afraid to kind of lay it all on the line, and you know, we're quite well known for making children cry in our shows, but because fear is a very important emotion that, unfortunately, due to our, you know, our PC world of helicoptering parents, a child being scared or crying is seen as a negative when in fact it's a very real emotion, and if we continue to deny it, people are growing up ill-equipped to deal with the world that they're going right. to be living in. Well, that's my argument anyway.
So is the show that you're working on at the moment around a concept of fear?
Well, no, I've been... I did a work in Cesena last year with Chiara, where we took 25 children on a journey of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Okay.
So it was a journey with love, searching for friendship, and discovering that friendship had volunteered itself up to death because death was coming to take love.
Okay.
So the love and friendship were characters.
Right.
You know, in Italian it's amore and amica.
Yeah, okay.
And the children on that journey from meeting love and finding out what she was going through, they meet a group of women who all die.
Wow.
And then they observe death taking Amika and the women, and then one of the children is invited to go with death to the underworld or to the land of the earthworms, and then the children go with love to Terra Dell'Umbriche, the land of the earthworms, and they bargain with death to return friendship to love.
Okay. And that's profound.
And it's extraordinary because the children, some of them, they were like 5 years old.
Yeah.
And in the world that we live in, there would be a lot of people that say, isn't that content just a bit too much for children? You go, well, no, not really. Like children are the ones that bounce. Children, you know, like if a child falls over, they pick themselves up. If a child witnesses death, then a child deals with it. Or in crisis is an opportunity for change. Crisis is a time for us to seek opportunity. And I think that adults underestimate the wisdom of children. And
yeah.
That, you know, when an adult says to me, in relation to, say, their dinosaur show, is the show too scary for my child? My answer is, I don't know your child and I don't know how you've raised them.
Mm.
So I can have a three-year-old sitting on stage sticking their head into the mouth of one of the most dangerous carnivores in the world and they're perfectly fine, while an 11-year-old is like clutching his head, like terrified of...
Yeah.
Because everybody's going on a different journey.
And does this show that you're working on involve puppets at all?
There's a couple of women in... There are three women in the show that had heads made of ice.
Oh, wow.
And we're looking at making them sort of be a bit more ventriloquist.
So to actually...
have
moving ice jaws or... Fantastic. Oh, I've never seen that before. Wow. So have you done any testing with working with ice or...
Well,
or is it
in Cesena we were making two or three new heads every day.
Okay.
But it was on a very, like, Chiara works on a basis of povero, like very little money.
Yeah.
And that's her choice.
Okay.
And so we were making ice heads on a very low budget, and which was charming, but you know, if I can convince some of the festivals in Australia to bring the show out here, then the first thing will be to make moving parts for them.
Yeah.
Okay. There are a few dead birds that were hidden around in the set that were positioned only where children could see them.
Okay.
There were... it is a very visual show. There's a visual language to it. As far as puppetry goes, I think
not
I think
as we know
there's
it.
Not as much as I'm really interested in the children. I'm really interested in what they say and what they see.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, in the next few years, that is one of my journeys as far as understanding them better so that the work that I do make for them is better informed.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's exciting.
I really love laboratories. So we've started to... I'm trying to phase out the words creative development from Earth's vocabulary.
And use
that we
laboratory.
Only do laboratories.
Yeah.
With Prehistoric Aquarium, it was informed by a whole lot of laboratories that we did that included children being brought into the process. Yeah. And the things that we discovered when we were able to kind of bring children into our world, and when you say to a child, would you like to be a part of my creative development, and a child looks at you and goes, what are you talking about? Whereas if you say, would you like to come into my laboratory, it already kind of conjures up a whole lot of ideas of experimentation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, it's a much more welcoming and a much more conducive sort of word.
Yeah. I think you're right, and it's definitely creating a space where everybody's learning. So not just the kids who were there or the audience who were there, but the everybody in the room.
Yeah.
We're all experimenting together. So you could say collaborating, but it's learning and experimenting. I agree, and I think the term laboratory is particularly used in Europe. I know Teatro Giocavita, the company that I train with, they have a shadow laboratory, and it's a great place to be, a place of curiosity. Yeah, which, you know, is a natural place for kids to be in the world anyway.
Mm.
So that's fantastic. And what else have you got going on just before we finish?
So I'm making another show with another group of artists of disability called Giant's Bedroom, and that is in its very early infancy. There's potential for an owl made of wedding dresses for one of the performers. There's the use of sort of technology as a form of kind of like a living wallpaper.
Living wallpaper sounds amazing.
There's we've got a games software person who's working with one of the girls, and they're making a computer game, and that computer game may or may not be projected onto a table that then becomes a place where the audience has a meal.
Okay.
You know, like, I think the thing with Earth is, for a long time we've focused on trying to make work that will help us be financially sustainable.
Yeah.
And now that dinosaurs are starting to tick over, and aquarium seems to be, you know, only just premiered at the Adelaide Festival, but we've already got a pretty full year of touring for 2017. So we know that money's coming in, but it's sort of allowing us that freedom to go, let's make this with that group of people, or let's start a laboratory with them. I'm really interested in the idea of using some high-end sex dolls as ready-made puppets. You know, I don't, and I want to be really clear about them being high-end. You know, I don't want to make them. I want to go and spend $10,000 and get top-of-the-range, world-class, high-end sex dolls that are designed for a lot of activity, and modify them so that they can be used as puppets, and maybe work with dancers and
yeah, okay.
Ooh. You know, look at sort of the language around those things. The robot arm seems like a lot of fun. I like to go back to using the technology or the projection. We've done some things with projection that when we did it, like about 6 or 7 years ago, it was the first time I'd ever seen it happen. And I'm not aware of. I think King Kong kind of used it on a much larger scale much later on, but using projection mapping as a way of creating a virtual corridor of light allows for front projection and no need for side lighting. And I'd like to go back and play with that a bit more. I like the idea of using infrared as another way of sort of you know, I think as puppeteers or as people who work with puppetry, we are kind of seen as magicians or as as magic makers. And I think it's a really important element in what we do. And there's got to be a degree of investigation, interrogation, and sort of there should be no limitations. We should be aiming to sort of try and do things that have never been done before, or to challenge ourselves, because if you don't, then the work just becomes very stale and repetitive. And I don't think Earth would survive if we just sort of repeated a familiar formula.
Yeah, it's fantastic that you're still experimenting and still curious, still wanting to have laboratories and discover things that are yet to be discovered. It's really important that we have people and artists who are doing that kind of work, I think, in Australia. So thanks, Scott, for talking with us today.
That's right.
And good luck with all your future projects.
Cheers.
Oh, that was lovely.